843. We are conducting this hearing via Zoom. Appearing on behalf of the appellant David Taylor is Natalie Greaves, and on behalf of the respondent Wendy Taylor is Rudy Patrick. Ms. Greaves, you may present your opening argument.
Thank you. Good morning. As announced, my name is Natalie Greaves, and I will be representing appellant David Taylor. Just to give a very brief recitation of the facts, I know the court has read the briefs, but the parties were divorced in April of 2012, and by virtue of that judgment, David paid his former wife, Wendy, $2,260 per month in spousal maintenance. So doing the math, that means at the time of filing to terminate his spousal maintenance, David had paid Wendy $198,880. Trial was set for March 26, 2020, but vacated due to COVID. David filed for a motion for summary judgment on He filed for a motion for summary judgment on April 27th, 2020, and no oral argument was held on the motion. Judge Thompson granted the motion on June 2nd, 2020, but set the end date for spousal maintenance to be June 15th, 2020. There was no reasoning given for this date in that order. In fact, the court stated in the order that is found on page 174 of the record that because spousal maintenance was no longer necessary, the court did not need to address the factors of code 327052 to determine the amount and period of time for any spousal support. David then filed a motion for reconsideration, arguing that the court's findings of fact and the granting of the motion for summary judgment for lack of a genuine issue of material fact was inconsistent with the conclusion of law granting an additional 10 months of spousal maintenance to Wendy past the date of filing. The court denied that motion for reconsideration and rejected the argument that the last payment should be the first day of the month after the date of filing for modification. The court did not address any factors or give any reasoning as to why Wendy should receive continued spousal maintenance, but just simply stated that it was within the court's discretion to decide the end date. David then filed a second motion for summary judgment on a different issue. And in the order granting that motion for summary judgment, the court referred back to the end date of spousal maintenance and for the first time stated, Wendy was entitled pursuant to the stipulated judgment to spousal maintenance up and until the order regarding summary judgment was entered. It would therefore cause the least disruption to both parties to set the termination date after the June 2nd, 2020 order regarding summary judgment was entered. Now, of course, we understand that the duration of spousal maintenance is an issue of discretion for the magistrate court. However, the court must comply with the standards for discretion, which is to perceive it as an issue of discretion, to act within the outer boundaries of that discretion, to act consistently with legal standards that are applicable, and to reach the decision by exercise of reason. And we believe that the court recognized its discretion but failed in the other three ways. The trial court's decision was not consistent with the plain language of the statute and relevant case law. There was logical inconsistency in the court's decision between the court's findings and the court's conclusion of law. There was a lack of specific reasoning, and the decision is inconsistent with public policy behind the reason for spousal maintenance. With regard to the plain language of the statute, the rule of family law 201 tells us that modifications are adjudicated in the same manner as original cases. And so Idaho Code 32705 discusses when spousal maintenance should be granted. And the case law tells us that she did not need spousal maintenance any longer, which was consistent with what the judge found in his ruling granting the summary judgment. So modification is proper when she no longer requires that. It's inconsistent then to say that she did not require it any longer, and yet we're going to keep that going for 10 more months. And that's where we get to the logical inconsistency. The court stated that Wendy was entitled, and he used that word, to spousal maintenance up until the date of the order was entered. But the question is why? Why would she be entitled to that? If the court found by summary judgment that as of the date of the filing of the petition, she no longer needed it.
Ms. Greaves?
Yes.
I guess I want to clarify something. You if I'm understanding what you're saying that she, when the district court said she was entitled to it, there was no grounds for that entitlement. But wouldn't the grounds be the previously entered order for spousal support? And that's what awarded her the spousal support until a court ordered differently?
And thank you for that question, Your Honor. I understand that point. However, that would be, that would work if the judge hadn't also found, made specific findings that there was no genuine issue of material fact that as of the date of the filing of the petition, Wendy no longer needed support. I think this would be a very different case if the case had gone completely to trial, the court had had to take evidence, then clearly that would be a different case where during the pendency of that trial, that would make more sense. But when there was no genuine issue of material fact that as of the date of filing, she didn't need it, then that seems logically inconsistent to me. And I think there's some good reasons why that would create a difficulty. For one thing, it encourages a litigant to delay proceedings. It puts all of the, all of the difficulty on one party, the party that the court later found was entitled to relief. In this particular case, there were practical issues outside of my client's control, which was partly due to COVID, because the trial was set for March and then it was vacated. And again, all of that burden fell directly on him, even though the court found that he was the party entitled to relief.
But then, Ms. Greaves, if we accept the premise of your argument, then wouldn't it be true that in every case in which a court grants a summary judgment motion, it would have to retroactively terminate spousal support to the date of filing?
And, in the district court, I think, made a statement similar to that. I do not believe that that is the case, because part of the concern that we have here is the court didn't have an oral argument, didn't take any evidence. For example, in this case, we filed a motion for summary judgment. The opposing party did not include any declaration, any verification. There were no facts presented. There was only legal argument. So there was no facts and controversy aside from our position, which frankly, I think could result in us, I guess, winning what we're asking for when they didn't controvert any of that. So I think that's a very different case. And versus, for example, if the court would have held a hearing and taken evidence, but there was nothing before the court except for what we had provided.
Well, so didn't the parties, they did controvert whether, even if there was a change in circumstances, whether those circumstances were sufficient to terminate spousal support. They did controvert that claim, didn't they?
They did by legal argument, but not by any evidence presented, not even a signed verification to the pleading. And so whether or not that's sufficient, I guess, is unclear to me. I would argue that it's not, that this is a very limited case, that this is not a situation where every summary judgment would result in modifying back to the date of filing. However, I do believe that a summary judgment granted by the court would shift the burden to a certain extent to the other party to have to show, if the court has found that, for example, in this case, on June 2nd, there is no genuine issue of material fact, then it would seem to me that the party that's losing that motion would need to provide some evidence to show why between the date of filing and June 2nd, she was entitled to continue to receive spousal maintenance. The only time the court really said anything as far as reasoning was that it would be the least disruptive to the parties. And of course, that always will favor the party who's not wanting the change. So that's not really an equal consideration, because of course, having my client have to pay $22,600 is quite disruptive to him. As I said, we had no opportunity to even present any information about how disruptive it would be. There was nothing before the court that would allow the court to make that implicit finding. Just briefly, with regard to public policy, the purpose of spousal maintenance is for financial rehabilitation, and that's exactly what happened in this case. She did need help originally, and the provision did exactly what it was supposed to do, but there's no policy that the former spouse should continue to be financially responsible once the need is no longer in place. With that, I think I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Ms. Greaves, I do have one clarifying question for you.
Absolutely.
As I understand this case, the phrase spousal maintenance encompasses both what I'll call alimony and the life insurance obligation. So at this point, when you are referring to spousal maintenance, are you just referring to that $2,260 a month payment, or are you referring to the life insurance obligation as well?
Thank you for that question. We're just referring to the $2,260. The life insurance provision, those payments were already made to the insurance company, so there's really nothing to, we haven't contested that.
And that obligation was also terminated pursuant to the second motion for summary judgment?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Patrick, argument on behalf of the respondent.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you cut out for just a moment. Would you repeat what you said?
I was just inviting you to present arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for hearing this case. I represent Wendy Taylor, who's come to this. And Your Honor, this case, I know the court's read the pleadings. I have a great reliance on the pleadings this morning as they come to you. And the parties divorced in April of 2012. The respondent agreed to make those payments, and there were conditions for termination. There were the payments being $2,260 a month. He had done quite well at the time, and he agreed to support his wife and work with her into the future, as well as providing the insurance and some other things. And it would terminate when he reached 67, when he retired, or when she remarried. And in March of 2019, she had a marriage ceremony. He filed his initial pleading in August, contending that she had remarried. When he found out and the judge enforced the rule that she had not, he then came back and amended the pleading so that he could say that there were substantial change in circumstances. This has repeatedly been characterized, and I think is characterized today, as an issue of discretion for the court, as the court, we're looking at her questions. Did the district court err in concluding that the magistrate had not abused his discretion when he terminated spousal support on June 15, 2020 instead of August 2019? And did he err in concluding that the magistrate did not abuse discretion in denying attorney's fees? And Your Honor, I think we've laid out the case with several precedents. And I just believe the court has granted, and as I continue to practice family law, the court has rightly granted broad discretion to our magistrates to handle these divorces and to work on and craft circumstances or solutions that work for the people that are involved. And I believe that's exactly what has happened in this case. The court chose within its discretion to say that spousal support would terminate on this date, and the district court found that that was within the discretion. My colleague quoted the four reasons that are in place when analyzing discretion. And I believe I have those in my notes. I thought I did. Correct perception within the outer boundaries of that discretion, consistent and applicable, and reaches a decision by, well, all of a sudden I can't read my writing, I apologize. But the court understands those, and my colleague quoted them. I just think this is a lot of ado about the court's discretion, and the court has clearly acted within that discretion, which is granted to them very broadly. As far as the accusation of frivolity in responding to their case, and that's the attorney's fees portion of their brief, I have to say that it's very unfortunate that the unsigned file was attached to the pleading when it was sent in. I did not find out until much later, but an unsigned pleading, as the court, the magistrate court noted, would constitute not having evidence, but not making a defense is not a frivolous response. And looking back, I should have probably asked the court to reconsider that, but that is not a frivolous response. It's just not having evidence. And even so, on the legal arguments that counsel admitted that I made, she says that the court made its decision based upon those. And I just can't get past the fact that the court acted in its sound discretion, which it can do. And Your Honors, I would ask the appeals court to affirm that decision and find that that's what the magistrate court did. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Patrick. Ms. Greaves, do you wish to present a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. You know, to be frank, if the court can enter an order and the discretion is upheld when there's no reasoning given, and the one reason that was given not in response to the motion or the motion to reconsider, but in a separate motion, when the reason given is that it would be least disruptive, if that falls within the outer bounds of the court's discretion, then clearly we lose. But my concern with that is then the right to appeal is pretty limited, extremely limited, really, because that would mean that a court can enter an order with there was no way that my client could have known that he was supposed to provide information that it would be disruptive to him if it continued. That's concerning to me, that there's no notice given. It's concerning to me that there was no consideration of the factors of 32705. It's concerning to me that the conclusion of the end date is not consistent with the court's factual findings that were made in the case. That's concerning to me, and that does not seem to fall within the outer bounds of a court's discretion. And I think that our position on that is consistent with the case law that has been cited in our brief, particularly Brazier and Mulch. I did want to correct something that I think maybe was misstated, not on purpose, but as far as the timeline here, the amended pleading that we filed was before, it was pretty immediate actually, before December 4th when the court heard the argument. There was no delay based on our motion to amend the pleadings to add specific substantial material circumstances. And our original petition actually did include a reference to the family law equivalent of Rule 60 that said that it should no longer have prospective application. So though we amended to include specific findings specific reasons for substantial material change of circumstances, that caused no delay in this case. Just very briefly about attorney's fees, we would ask the court to remand for the magistrate court to consider really the totality of actions here. It actually was not just one unsigned file. It was both. It was both responses to both motions for summary judgment that were not signed. And it wasn't just that they weren't signed. There was a lot of things. Wendy didn't respond until an intent to file default was filed. There was no response to our motion, no response to our discovery request until we filed a motion. She refused to go to mediation. All along, there was no cooperation and no moving this case forward to allow my client to have his case heard by the court. In a perfect world, he would have been able to go and file and be able to have the court hear his case that day or the next day or the next week, but that's not the world we live in. And for the burden to completely fall on the party that the court later found was correct in filing to modify does not seem to be within the court's discretion to do. And for those reasons, we would ask for this court to overturn this decision and return it to the magistrate court for further consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graves. The court appreciates the briefing and argument of counsel. The case is submitted and a written decision will issue in due course. The court will be in recess to the 10:30 argument on February 8th. Thank you.
Thank you.